Okay, we were in the middle of discussing how secular Zionism could have been attributed as a cause of the Holocaust. And we explained basically up until now that the philosophy of secular Zionism is another form of assimilation, except not assimilation to be lost totally amongst the nations, but to be a nation amongst nations just like everybody else. And that's also assimilation. It's national assimilation. It's substituting the Torah with nationalism. And that is the reason why the Yishuv refused, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and the Yishuv HaYoshen refused to speak Hebrew. Ivrit. In fact, they called it Ivrit with two vavs, the blind language. Because the people who were pushing in this time, the early 1900s, the very beginning of the secular Zionist movement, especially after they voted to be involved with culture and education, and meaning that it's not only that they wanted to establish a state or a homeland in Eretz Yisrael, or for that matter in anywhere where they could have it, but they wanted to make sure that that homeland would be a secular one. And their philosophy was that philosophy, the majority at least, was that that homeland and the Hebrew language was a substitute for Torah. Torah maybe was necessary to keep the Jewish people as an entity in Golus. But when we have our own land, the land and the language give us the ability to be an entity. And therefore, since the Hebrew language was seen as something that substituted for Torah, they refused to speak it. Again, just as Rav Kook had said, that if the Zionists continue to say that Eretz Yisrael is a substitute for Torah, then we Rabbanim are going to have to de-emphasize totally Eretz Yisrael in order not to make a mistake. That people don't read us wrong and say that we have the same hashkafa as they do. So the Yishuv held the same thing when it came to Ivrit. And they didn't, what's it called, they didn't speak Ivrit, only Yiddish. And it's interesting that later on, the Chazon Ish paskened differently. And when they had to decide in the 1950s what language should be the language of instruction in the Beis Yaakovs and in the Chinuch Hatzmoy schools, the Chazon Ish said it has to be Ivrit. They have to teach in Ivrit. And everybody was shocked. The Chazon Ish went off the derech. Like the Yishuv HaYoshen made a holy war against Ivrit. Famous story that it's recorded that happened to Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. I once sent this over to a group of Beis Yaakov teachers and principals, and somebody came over to me and said that in her family, she is a descendant of Rav Yadler, Ben Sion Yadler, who wrote a lengthy Perush on Medrash Rabbah. He was the Maggid of Yerushalayim, Ben Sion Yadler, a very famous person. And she told me that in their family they have Mesorah, that Maisa happened with their relative, Rav Ben Sion Yadler, not with Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. Whoever it happened to, I'm not sure if it happened altogether, but I think it's a cute maisa. And that is that supposedly Eliezer ben Yehuda, who was the father of modern Hebrew, met either of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld or Ben Sion Yadler, and he said to him, "I don't understand why you people are opposed to Ivrit. It's Lashon HaKodesh. What could be wrong with Lashon HaKodesh? So whoever it was answered that wine is also very holy. Right? You can use it for Kiddush, Havdalah, Kosher Bracha, but if the wrong person touches the wine, it becomes also to drink. In Shir HaShirim it says, Chikech Kiyein HaTov, your palate is like wine. Just like wine can be holy, but if the wrong person touches it, it becomes Aser. So too language can be Lashon HaKodesh, but if the wrong people touch it, it becomes Aser. So he said, you people have turned that language into something that's apikursis, it's in a substitute for Torah, so it became Aser. So supposedly Eliezer ben Yehuda said, Harav medaber shtusim, to which whoever it was said, Be'ivrit omrim shtuyot. So that's the ma'isa, whether it happened or not, I'm not sure. So when the Chazon Ish paskened that they should use Hebrew, spoken Hebrew, as the language of instruction in the Chinuch Atzmoi, in Beis Yaakov's, so everybody was shocked. So somebody went and asked him. So he said the following. He said that if you had a general who was an excellent strategist in World War I, and now it's World War II, and you take that general out of the retirement, and you ask him to give you a strategy for an air battle that's going to take place, and he gives you a strategy that applies to box planes, put him back into retirement. They're not fighting with box planes anymore. You're fighting with jets or propeller planes. Right? So it's not the same kind of weapons. It's not the same war. It's a different war. So the same thing. The war that Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was fighting was a war with people who had grown up basically in frum homes, had rebelled against their parents, gone off the derech, but were looking for something to substitute for what they were brought up on, Torah. So they needed something as a substitute for Torah mitzvahs, and they took Eretz Yisrael and Lashon HaKodesh as a substitute. He said, we lost that battle long ago. He said, we're fighting today a different war completely. We're fighting with people who don't need a substitute for Torah mitzvahs. They are totally estranged from it. They've been already 2-3 generations away completely from Torah and mitzvahs. They were brought up in homes that were void of Torah and mitzvahs. So if we are going to teach in a language that they don't understand, we're going to lose a whole generation. So now the war is a different war. You have to fight it with different kalim. And we have to teach in the language that they understand. Maybe we'll save some of them. Maybe we'll salvage some of them. If we teach in a language that's foreign to them, we've lost that generation. So we're fighting a different war. So that's what he held. And therefore they take Torah, even Gedolei Yisrael give their shiurim in Hebrew. Like of Shach, I heard him give shiurim. He didn't give shiurim in Ivrit. He gave it in Ivrit. Just the spoken language. Right? Because that's the vernacular. It's not, when it represented something and there was a war to fight, you had to fight the war. When that war is gone, and you're fighting different wars, and you have to deal differently. In any case, so we were up last time to the Balfour Declaration. So by this point, the Mizrahi pulled away from the Zionist movement because they voted to have on their agenda culture and education, which means that they weren't satisfied with just creating a homeland, but that the homeland should be secular. And the Mizrahi held that they could work together with the Zionist movement on the common ground of building a state, and then they'll fight over what kind of state it's going to be. And the most Gedolei Yisrael held that you can't do that, because you're not talking about working together with non-frum people, we're talking about working together with an ideology that itself is apikursis, so there's no common ground with such a thing. And they held that it's usher to work together with the Zionist movement. And they worked on settling in Eretz Israel, but not to have a political entity. They held that that wasn't necessary. And it may have been even negative, according to some Shitas, that having a political entity is Yalu Bechom. I think we discussed that last time. And they worked on working together with the Arabs, under the Arabs, of getting permission to settle in Eretz Israel. That was the Aguda. As things progress closer to World War II, they have a Dr. Dahan, who was very, very active in working together or trying to get the Arabs to agree to let the Jews settle, which would have made it not so important to have a state. And the secular Zionists saw that that would take a lot of wind out of their sails, and they had this Dahan assassinated. So that's another point of contention against the secular Zionists, that they wouldn't stop short of murder either. In fact, the Maisa once heard from the Brisker Rav, there was a real Hesa anti-Zionist guy in Brisk, in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim. But he came davened by the Brisker Rav. And one Shabbos he came and he said, I really gave it to them, what's it called, I protested and I said something, mamish in their face, connected them. And the Brisker Rav looked at him and said, you're a Tzioni. This guy was like shocked. He was the most anti-Tzioni you can imagine. So he said, if you're not choshed them for Shrichas Domin, and you put your life in danger by saying what you said openly to these people, then obviously you're soft on the Tzioni. So you're a Tzioni. If you're not choshed, that they would kill you for this. And then now things have come to light that the secular Zionists aside from what's reported in perfidy, right, of how much they either were indifferent to what was going on in Europe, or some of them used it because it was good. It was good for the state that Jews are being killed. They didn't stop what they could have stopped, and they wouldn't divert funds from that were put aside for creating a state to save Jews, which they could have saved from the Holocaust. It's not everybody, right? But there were definitely people like that, and it wasn't the accusation of the Eda Haredis, it was the accusation of other secular Zionists. There was a trial, right? The Kastner trial. So this was a part of history, that they didn't do what they could have done because they held that, as what's his name said, famous Greenbaum, that a cow in Eretz Israel is more important than a religious Jew in Europe. And he would rather spend money on providing another cow in Eretz Israel than saving the Jewish life from the concentration camps and what was going on in Europe. There were people like that also. Not everybody was like that either. But there were people like that. And there were people that from the time that they were able to start working towards a state that came here and did everything in their power to secularize the Frum community here. To make schools, to pull the kids away from Torah. To what's it called? To mamish fight the Eda. They held that from Yiddishkeit would last another generation or two, and that they'd be finished with it. And anything they could do to thwart its growth, they did. So this was a cultural war that went on, not only in the Zionist congresses, but Lamaisa, in Eretz Israel. It was a very emotional kind of thing that people who have been here for generations remember. A very emotional fight, war. So in any case, after 1917, after the Balfour Declaration, so they tried to get people to come and settle here. There were waves of Aliyah. Most of them were not from, and that was partially machinated, because the English right away in the beginning saw they can't have unlimited emigration to Eretz Israel, because the Arabs were extremely upset with the Balfour Declaration. And they started the Arab National Movement. They never had an Arab National Movement, but once it was a Jewish National Movement, the Arabs organized and had their Arab National Movement. And they saw the danger that what they considered theirs is going to be taken over by the Jews. And so the English saw that they made a big mistake, and they limited immigration, and they only gave out a certain amount of certificates for immigration. This is between the two world wars. And the secular Zionists made sure that very few from people were given these certificates, even people who wanted them. So the idea that from people didn't emigrate is partially true, that they didn't emigrate because they weren't interested in emigrating, some of them. But a lot of people wanted to emigrate. And they couldn't because they couldn't get certificates, because they were controlled by the Zionist organization, and they would not give them to from people. They didn't want from people here. They wanted to create a secular society, and the less from people were here, the better it was for them. So in fact, the early settlements, before the Zionists started to create settlements here, were all from. All of them were from. So there were people who wanted to come and settle here and build the land. But once the Zionist organization was the official representative of the Jewish community, they made sure that not too many from people could come here. And that the from people who were here were given circumstances and a war against them to try to decimate them. So between 1917 and 1930s, when Hitler came to power, the English tried very hard to minimize what they permitted in the Balfour Declaration. And by 1939, by the beginning of World War II, they completely revoked it. They had what was called the White Paper, where they had a commission study the matzav here in Eretz Israel between the Arabs and the Jews, and basically they said that there can't be any more Jewish immigration into Eretz Israel. It'll upset the status quo between the Arabs and the Jews, and they were very, very much one-sided towards the Arabs and against Jews, to the point where the Zionist movement split in how to deal with the British. The British became an enemy. And they didn't let Jews in here. And when it became obvious, when Hitler came to power, that it was necessary to open up Eretz Israel for immigration for Jews who wanted to leave Europe, and the British refused, there were those that broke off from the establishment of the Zionist movement, Zionists, who became an underground terror organization, Mamish. Begin was part of that, of fighting the British with bombs and whatever. And then the establishment, for the most part, were against that. And they fought each other like enemies. It just came out now with Teddy Kollek, that he was a Moser. That he, what's it called, mastered on Begin and on others, what's it called, that the British, if they would have caught them, would have hung them. And he served the British, basically, as part of the Zionist establishment. So, mitzad Yiddishkeit, there was a lot of negative in those times, and mitzad the Yishuv here altogether, not too much was accomplished because of the British. So, and this went on till World War II. By World War II, like you said, for all practical purposes, the furtherance of creating a state here was almost an impossibility. It was a dream that probably wouldn't have happened. What changed that was World War II. When 6 million Yidden were killed, and the survivors had nowhere to go. And there was at least some sympathy in the world, not too much, but some, for the Jewish people because of what happened. So now it was opportune to push for a homeland, for some place that Yidden could go. The rest of the world didn't want them. The British weren't letting them into Eretz Israel. Anybody who tried to come into Eretz Israel, because again, they were very afraid of upsetting the Arabs. So they either fired on the boats that came here, or they captured them and sent the people on them to Cyprus, to DP camps, and eventually would send them back to Europe. So before World War II, when Jews were trying to escape Germany, Austria, when it was still possible to escape, there was no place to go. And the famous stories of the voyage of the damned, the St. Louis or whatever, they went around the world and were sent back to Europe, to the concentration camps, basically. Because no country would take them in. And after the war, it was the same thing. Jews who went home to Poland, Ukraine, Germany, Austria, any of the places that they were originally from, and came back and wanted to claim their homes that were taken by the anti-Semites who hated them more than the Nazis did. So they were summarily killed. No, none of these people wanted to give up the homes that they took over, the property they took over. And they hated the Jews anyway. So most Jews who were survivors who tried to go back to Poland or Lithuania or whatever were murdered. So they couldn't go back. There's no place to go back to. And no other country wanted to take them in. Even America had very, very small quotas for Jews, even after World War II. So the only possibility was that the shores of Eretz Israel be open. But as long as the British were there, they weren't going to do that, because they didn't want to upset the Arabs. So now they started to push very hard for a Jewish homeland. And the United Nations appointed a commission, the Peel Commission, to decide what to do with the Arab-Israeli conflict in the Middle East, what to do. And the United Nations came to the conclusion that the solution should be a two-state solution, partition of the land, part for the Arabs, part for the Jews. The way they partitioned it is that there was a little bit of land for Jews, most of it for Arabs. We had a little enclave, Ramla, around Ramla, and part of Yerushalayim, and Tel Aviv, and the rest was all Arab. Mamish, with a little bit of enclaves of Jews, not like the Arabs now want, you know, continuous land. We didn't have any continuous land. It was a little bit here, a little bit there. Were a lot of Arabs in between. Right? In the north was mostly Arabs. And what most people felt is that even if they would go through with this and they'd have this partition plan, it wouldn't take long. The Arabs would just overrun the Jews and solve the problem to everybody's happiness except ours. So, give the Jews a place where they can make it into a cemetery when the Arabs attack them. And the Arabs didn't accept it. Now they're, we want two states or whatever. Then they could have had their state. Baruch Hashem, the sad truth is, Baruch Hashem, they didn't accept it. Had they accepted it, they probably wouldn't be, we wouldn't be here. So they didn't accept it. They wanted everything. The most they wanted is a binational state. In other words, one state, Arabs and Jews, and they would be the majority eventually, and that would be the end. So the Arabs refused, and they said that if the Jews declare a state, they will declare war and throw us into the sea. They're not going to accept the United Nations recommendation. The Shaila was what the Jews wanted. On the one hand, to accept a portion of Eretz Israel is also not so partial. Right? So it's like admitting that the whole thing is not ours. So there were Rabbanim that were against partition. Even Gedolei Yisrael that said, it's a ka'ev to do it, but Lamaisa, we have no other choice. Pikuach nefesh. So on the one hand, to accept the partition and not to say it's all ours was no good. On the other hand, to accept anything, there were Rabbanim who were against Bechlau having a state. Like we said, that's Yalu Bechoma. According to some, even with political pressure, to have a state in Eretz Yisrael before Mashiach, some Rabbanim held was awesome. So most Gedolei Yisrael didn't hold like that. Or Sameach, for sure, wrote clearly that once the, what's it called, the nations of the world, after World War II in San Remo, the Allies got together and they decided that, what's it called, that nothing after World War, after World War I, and that they're going to give England the mandate. And England said that they're willing to let Klal Yisrael have a homeland in Eretz Yisrael, there's no more problem of the Gimel Shvuos. And so too many Gedolim said that after the United Nations voted in 1947, November, that in November 27th, I think something like that, in November 27, 1947, that, what? 29th? I think it was 29th. Well, it's supposed to be 27. Whatever. They, Chav Tes November. And they, what's it called, they, then there's no more problem of Yalu B'choma. You got it with the permission of the nations of the world. The Satmar Rebbe held differently. He held that Lamaisa, the people who live here, didn't give us permission. The fact that the United Nations voted is very nice, but they weren't here. The Arabs didn't want us. So we had to fight the Arabs to actualize what we were given permission. And since we had to fight for it, that's called Yalu B'choma. He also held that even if we didn't have to fight, but the pressure put on the nations of the world was also. However, before the Peel Commission made its decision, before the United Nations voted on this decision of the Peel Commission to have partition, they made the Drisha V'Chakira. They interviewed every Jewish organization and the Arabs, everybody, to get all the information. And if any Jewish faction would have said, we don't want a state, which, yeah, go to hell, we don't need a state, the Dafka, right, then it would definitely would have been that the United Nations would not have voted to give us, because the Jews don't want it. Why should we, you know, go on a limb to give them a state? They themselves not, don't want it. They're disunited. So they saw that it was pikuach nefesh, that if they didn't have a state, if they didn't declare a state, then there'd be no place for these, what are called, refugees to go. And there were hundreds, not thousands, of Jews whose lives were mamish in danger. So all the organizations, without exception, the Aguda, and obviously the other ones, secular Zionists, but everybody, agreed that they would not, they would have a united stand in front of the United Nations. We all want a state. The Aguda said, we are willing to say that under one condition, that if you do make a state, that you don't make the conditions there less than they were under the English Lagabe Yiddishkeit. In other words, what we were able to have under the mandate of Shabbos and Kashrus or whatever, that the secular Zionists shouldn't make anything less than that. The same status quo. That's the famous status quo. And they agreed, and the Aguda therefore agreed to go before the United Nations and say, we also want a state. And obviously that was the Das Gedolei Yisrael, because of Pikuach Nefesh. And because of that, partially because of that, the United Nations had no way out of saying, well, the Jews don't want it either, so they voted to partition Palestine. And the mandate of the English was over on May 15th, 1948, which was Vav Iyar, and which was a Shabbos. And till then, they debated, should they declare a state or not? They knew if they declare a state, that would enable Jews who were refugees to have a place to escape to come to Eretz Israel. But it also would mean the Arabs would declare war. So it would put other Jews in danger. And they debated. The Mandatory Council, which was the pre-state government, whether to declare the state or not. I mean, whatever they did was going to put somebody in danger. Where was the greater danger? And in the end, they decided to declare the state. And they should have declared the state on Shabbos when the English left, when the mandate was over. But Ben-Gurion understood that declaring the state on Shabbos would not be a practical thing to do, not a good tactical thing to do. And therefore, he declared it Friday, or one day early. So what happened on Hay Ear is nothing basically happened on that day, except that Ben-Gurion decided to declare the state. Nothing happened that day that made it have to declare the state that day or made it possible to declare. They could have declared any day before that from November 29th and on. And they really should have declared it. The last moment was the next day. So they just preempted it by one day. It's one of the reasons why even those people who hold that you can make a Yom Tov Bishman Hazeh, if a day has in it a Hatzolah Mimavus L'Chaim, but they hold that that day nothing happened that was Mimavus L'Chaim. It was an arbitrary kind of thing. And therefore it doesn't fit the criteria of making a Yom Tov. In any case, that's a side thing. So, therefore, the state was declared, and in Echinami, that day, a lot of Jews who were in these DP camps were able to be freed and came into Eretz Israel. The only problem is they came into Eretz Israel where a war had just been declared. Because the same day that they declared the state, the Yom HaTzmaut, the first Yom HaTzmaut, Friday, Ha'ir, that night, the Arabs declared war. And there was the war started. So many Jews that were released from these DP camps and now had some place to go aside from being sent back to Europe were given rifles and sent to the front that Friday night to fight the Arabs. And many of them never saw daylight in Eretz Yisrael. So they went from the frying pan into the fire. That doesn't mean that it was a mistake to do that, because the other way would have been also pikuach nefesh. But Lamaisa, to say that on Hay Ear there was a Hatzalah Mimavus L'Chaim, right, to a substantial amount of people is not true. Because those same people who were in danger before of being sent back to Europe were now in danger because the Arabs were making a war and made it dangerous for everybody here. And it's only with Nisim that we won that war, which we didn't really win. We just got the ceasefire and it's been going on since then. Just had a few timeouts. We're still fighting that same war. So, Lamaisa, at the point that the state was declared, so there were three different opinions of how to view that. The Mizrahi, I'm talking about the Frum, the secular Zionists obviously saw this as the completion of secular Zionism. Now the movement had its purpose of existence was to make a state, and they made a state. And the state was basically run by the secular Zionists. And it was a socialist state. There were three different opinions, though, in the Frum world of how to relate to the state. The Mizrahi obviously related to the state as the beginning of Geula. They saw a state in Eretz Israel as a necessary thing before Mashiach, the beginning of Geula. So here was the beginning. This is it. Reishis Michas Geula Seder. It's the beginning of Geula. It's obviously a momentous occasion. Galus is over. And now we have to work on making that state the kind of state that we want it to be. But Lamaisa, the fact that there's a state, is Geula. So you can understand that they celebrate it. The Aguda split into two factions. The majority of Gedolim of the Aguda, and the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah at the time was Reb Ruvein Grozovsky. He held, he was Baruch Ber's son-in-law, right? Yeah, Ruvein. So he was the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. He wrote a sefer called Bayos Hazman. It's a small, thin sefer, but it articulates the sheet of the Agud of Rov Gedolei Yisrael. Most of the Rosh Hashivas, Hasidish Rebbe's held that now that there's a state, even though we didn't bedafka want a state, and there doesn't have to be bedafka state here in Eretz Israel, if we could have settled under the Arabs, that would have been fine too. But because of circumstances, it was important to support the establishment of a state because of pikuach nefesh. Now that there's a state is not the same thing as secular Zionism. Secular Zionism is a movement, an ideology, which is apikorsis. And the Gedolim of the previous generation had said that you can't work together with apikorsim. Or with, not apikorsim, but with apikorsis. With an ideology that it's apikorsis, you can't work together with it. But the state's not an ideology. The state is a part of the institution. What its ideology is depends on the people who are in charge. And since it's a democracy, or something like a democracy, right, it's controlled by the people who get political power. And how do you get political power? By voting and being voted for. So Rov Gedolei Yisrael said, the state is different than the ideology of Zionism, even though the Zionists are the ones who run the state, but that's only because they have the power. But if we can wrest the power from them or mitigate their power, then we're saving that institution called the state to be as positive as it can be. So they held, and the Chazon Ish held like this, and the what's it called, the Ger Rebbe held like this. Most of the Hasidic Rebbe's, except for the Satmar, except for the Eda, except for Brisk, Kimat, all the other Shivas, Pondivisha Rav, again, the Chazon Ish, the Stipler held like that, everybody held. The Ger Rebbe held like that, that, what's it called, that being involved with the state is a mitzvah. Because that's the way that you can fight the secular Zionists. The way to fight them is by being involved in the political process. Because if you're not involved, then you're giving it into their hands. Then you've lost the battle. So they held a mitzvah to vote, a mitzvah to be part of the government, and the original government had in it two representatives of the Aguda, and the representative of Pauli Aguda, maybe even two, that, what's it called, that signed on the Declaration of Independence. And the other faction that split away from the Aguda, that originally were part of the Aguda and split away, that were basically the Eda, and the Brisk was never part of the Aguda altogether, the Eda and Satmar, they split away, and they made them Torah Karta. Torah Karta was originally part of the Aguda. And they held that the state and the Zionist ideology are the same thing. The state is just the manifestation of Zionism. And therefore, just like the Gedolim held, you couldn't have anything to do with Zionism, you can't have to do with the state. And you can't recognize it, you can't have any shaykhs to it.
Yes, I know.
Can't have any shaykhs to it, and to recognize a state that's called Israel, that is anarapi halacha, that's based on secular law, right, and is run by people who are apikorsim, is a chilul Hashem. And therefore, to acknowledge that such a state could be called Israel is a chilul Hashem. Not allowed to do such a thing. Can't even shaykh this. You can't support the state. You shouldn't benefit from the state. You're here under protest. That's what they held in Torah Karta, and that's what they still held today. And the Aden is pretty much the same, and the Brisker is pretty much the same. And as long as they're what's it called, consistent, you have to accept the fact that we may not agree with that, because Rov Gedolei Yisrael held that the state and secular Zionism are not the same. They're not. Right, and therefore, being involved in the political process is the way to fight it, not by what's it called, being machrim the whole situation. So that was a chiluk ideas amongst Gedolim, and therefore you can understand that the people in the Torah Karta look at the Yom HaTzma'ut as a day of mourning, because the day that a state was created, it's called Israel. That doesn't represent Klal Yisrael and Torah at all, and that that state is an issur of Yalu B'choma. It may have been necessary as Pikuach Nefesh at the time, but its existence on a regular basis is an issur. So they see that as a reason to mourn. Rov Gedolei Yisrael, like I said not like that. Rov of the Rosh Hashivas and the Gedolim that we're familiar with, held that the state is an entity to itself. It's not to be confused with secular Zionism, and the way to fight is by being involved in the political thing. It's not usher, because the United Nations gave us the right to make a state. It's not Yalo Yalo Bechomas. It's not usher. And there are therefore negative things about that state, definitely, right? Because it's in the hands of, and it's the way that it is. And there are positive things. And it doesn't mean that there's still a reason why, in essence, has to be a state. But Lemaisa, now that there's one, it has positive things about it, negative things about it. You have to recognize the positive and fight against the negative. That was the das of Rov Gedolei Yisrael. So you can understand that based on all of this, the secular Zionist movement itself, again, not to be confused with the state of Israel, which is a separate issue, but secular Zionism, that ideology, without exception, everybody held it up, of course, any or from people. Right? The etzem philosophy of secular Zionism is apikorsis. Its etzem philosophy is that Klal Yisrael is a nation because of nationalism, and that's what makes us a nation, not Torah. That's apikorsis. And like I told you, I think we mentioned this on Rav Kook. Yeah, he said, is this over Rav Kook? Yeah. That nobody disagrees with that. The question was how to deal with it. Is the way to deal with it to totally be machrin it, or to work together with it in the hope that if you'll gain the common ground, eventually we'll be mashpia on them? That was the feeling of Rav Kook, and later on by all Mizrahi, and they felt that if you can work with the secularists, eventually in Eretz Israel, they'll have a change of heart. And Lamaisa, we see, historically speaking, till today, it hasn't worked. Right? They never changed of heart, just the opposite. The people who worked with them, who were the closest with them, who held in the state or whatever, they're the ones that they hate the most now, the secularists. So they made a lahachrimam, and therefore now those same people who are so positive and can work with the secular Zionist movement or whatever now are more Neturei Karta than Neturei Karta. They're the ones now who don't say the tefillah for the Medina, and they, what's it called, they don't recognize anymore. They you hear some of them speaking, right? Some of the really super from Mizrahi. Right, they sound exactly like Neturei Karta. Mamish, exactly. If you wouldn't know who's saying it, you would say, think it's Neturei Karta. So, historically speaking, what Rav Kook would hoped would happen hasn't happened in 60 years, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen in the next 60 years. Al-Piderech HaTeva. So, and not only that, but the people, the education, therefore, of the Mizrahi, to a good portion, okay, until recently where they had different derech bechlal, but the regular what's the word I'm looking for, establishment Mizrahi, that felt closer to the secular Zionists because of their common ground of a state than they did to the Haredi population, and therefore made their schools more of a pshara, where they had these secular values and nationalistic values, and together with the religious values, but wherever there was a conflict, many people opted for the nationalistic values over the religious values. That was more important to them, and they lost a good number of their children. A good number before left Yiddishkeit and became secularists, became real secular Zionists. And that's a fact of history also. Right? I think Rabbi Chanan said that religious Zionism is a one-way street. Most people, it doesn't bring too many people back. Just the opposite. The street is going one way. Many of the people who started out from are no longer from. Because when they had a conflict between the two values, that they had a value system, the secular values overtook, or the nationalistic values overtook the religious values. In any case, so you can see why secular Zionism, which really had nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael for the real reason of Eretz Yisrael, could be another kind of assimilation, and even maybe a more dangerous kind of assimilation. It's a national assimilation. It's not assimilation on an individual level. It's a national assimilation. And if assimilation can be the cause of anti-Semitism and the cause of destruction, then this kind of assimilation could also be. And it's no steerer to the fact that there were other Gedolim who said that our desire or our lack of desire to make Aliyah when we have a chance to come to Eretz Yisrael is also a cause. Because there's no stira between blaming it on an ideology of secular Zionism which really has nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael. It's a separate value. And on the other hand, not appreciating Eretz Yisrael is also a form of assimilation by firm people. Which that Mirza Hashem we'll get to next week. That's the next reason. The next reason is that when we had a chance to come to Eretz Yisrael between World War I and World War II, there was a window. Many Fulmer Yidden didn't take the opportunity. From the end of the 1800s, middle 1800s, and on, more Fulmer Yidden could have come here. And the truth is, if they would have come here, then maybe the country would look completely different. And maybe the secular Zionists wouldn't have taken over when they did. Maybe the Fulmer Yidden would have had more than just a Yishuv HaYoshem. And then maybe, so that also is given as a reason. We understand why people didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. Right? There are all different reasons. But some of the reasons, we'll understand, is just the same thing again, only on a more frum level. But also assimilation. Different kind of assimilation. So it all boils down that the major cause of the Holocaust was assimilation. Either personal, individual assimilation, which we spoke about, or national assimilation, or what's it called, or an assimilation that applies even to Frum Jews, which is not being interested in leaving physical galus and coming to Eretz Yisrael. That we'll explain next time. Just interesting, something that Rav Chanan says in Ikvus of the Mashiach, he said that the two Avodah Zarahs that the Jews embraced before World War II was nationalism and socialism. Those were the two Avodah Zarahs that took over the youth of Klal Yisrael. And the Nazis put the two together and they were the National Socialist Party. So you have nationalism and socialism together. Right, gives a simen that may be the root of what gave them their power in Tuma was the fact that we embrace those two avodah zarahs of nationalism and socialism.